movers desert, the density of the air? How is the density of the desert greater than the jungle?
So the question is the jungle problem. If I had asked you what the density of a room full of helium was compared to a room full of air, everyone would have gotten it right? Maybe not, huh? So the helium per molecule weighs less than air does, and so a room full of helium is going to weigh less than a room full of air. So for water, the molecular weight is 18 as opposed to around 40 for air. So if we have some fraction of the molecules being 18 as opposed to 40, it's going to have a lower density.
Okay.
Right, so Avogadro's hypothesis is that same volume to pressure temperature, same number of molecules. Now some of them weigh less.
So how much does air weigh?
About 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter.
I guess I was assuming the same amount of air in both rooms, but I guess I was...
Well, it depends what amount is, right? So it's the same number of molecules in both rooms.
So if there's the same molecules of air in each room, but then one of the rooms has water that's taking up space, wouldn't that make the air more dense?
So it's the same number of molecules, counting everything, air, argon...
Water.
So it depends on which one we're talking about, right? O2 is going to be 32, N2 is going to be 28.
O2.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I see. 16 and 18 is what you were thinking.
I was thinking like 16 or like, what is nitrogen like?
14. Shame on you.
Here's what it is.
So...
I've been
in the... In the green box, you should find your score. That's a raw score equals a renormalized score on the 0 to 100 scale equals a grade. About half a centimeter below that, scribbled in blue, is my guesstimate as to your grade. So that includes your homework and 3 exams, and I kind of estimated 95 for your lab grades. So you may do a little bit better or a little bit worse, but it's probably a pretty close estimate for where you are. So that's 70% of your grade. The final counts twice. So 70% isn't... Say again?
What?
Yeah, the final counts double. So you can move it a little bit with your final. Kind of, I think 3 points are required. 3 points above your average on the final are required to move it 1 point in your average. So it's hard to move it more than a few points. But it can be moved. And down, let me say one more thing. At the bottom in the blue, you have your homework score. And if you have bonus points, there's a plus some number that's there. And all that has been factored into that overall score. And you might notice that it was a harder exam than last time. The high was 64 last time as opposed to 54. But it all kind of got washed out by setting the high equal to 100. So as a matter of fact, on average, people did better on this exam than they did on the previous exams. Okay.
So you just said that the final pretty much just moves like a couple or so. Like if you're right in the middle of a grade, you can pretty
It's going to be hard to move it. Yep.
So okay.
Yes, up or down. So let me say two things, I guess. The first thing I want to say is I'm really open to dropping me an email saying, what do I need on to get on the final to get grade X? So you can ask me how low you can get on the final and still get, say, a B or something like that, or how high it takes to get an AB. And the other thing I want to say is I have had one really bad experience that I always try and tell people about. So I had a student who was taking a course SU, and you know he had a normal sort of grade, and I said, you know, it's going to be pretty hard for the final to affect your final grade. And lo and behold, he got basically zero on the final, and so he flunked the course. So just because that is, so you can move your grade if you do really poorly, so don't do that. Neither of us were happy about that.
Do you still want us to email you if we were wondering if we could take the final the next day?
So the finals are scheduled for Monday, and I'm happy to have another time for people to take the final. So if you can do it on Monday, that's great. But if you can't, drop me. If you don't want to, not a matter of can't. If you don't want to, drop me an email, and we'll try and find a other time for people to do it.
Did you say you care which section we show up?
And I don't care. So one of them's like at 8, and I think the other one's maybe at 6 or something like that. But they're all on Monday. Yeah, something like that. Other questions?
What is the easiest way with the lab practicals, since there aren't any answers? Like, what is the best way to kind of go through them? Like, how do you know if it's right?
So let's back up for a second. So the lab practical should be the easiest exam you've ever taken, because we give you the exam beforehand. So you can go to the website and you can practice all you want. But the comment is, practice all you want. You don't know whether they're right or wrong. So if you drop me an email with your answers, I will tell you whether they're right or wrong. And you definitely want to practice for that lab practical. If you show up and read the lab for the first time, I would expect problems. Yeah, practice your lab practical. It's mostly about sig figs and units.
There's a lot of practicals. Oh, that's right.
Did you get my email?
I don't remember.
I sent you an email explaining that apparently I missed my last.
That you missed your what?
Last lab.
Oh. So what you probably want to do is drop an email to the lab manager, Lynn Schultz, and it's probably not a problem.
Lynn Schultz.
So his name is also on the opening page of that physics website. So this is the heat engine lab that you missed, the one that we just completed.
Yeah. I got all my free labs in the
way. Other questions? So there are answers online for screencasts. This is the kind of the usual grade cutoff that people asked for from the last class. Presumably we'll have a help session on the study day to be scheduled. Any last questions? So we've got just one last chapter, but it has a whole lot of stuff in it. And it starts off talking about stuff that we could have talked about long ago and have talked about long ago, is how springs work. So the basic idea of springs is pretty simple. The more you stretch it, the more it pulls back. And there's a linear relationship between the amount of stretch in the spring and the corresponding force that it produces. So that's called Hooke's law. And there's one kind of funny thing, and that's this minus sign. So I remind you, the sole meaning of the minus sign is the direction of the force. So if I pull this thing down some distance, the force is in the positive x direction. If I compress this spring, and it's actually hard to do with this spring, then the force would be down. So all that minus sign is telling you is the direction of the force. We also had equations for the potential energy of a spring. So the potential energy was 1/2 the spring constant. This K is called the spring constant. It's not something you could look up in a CRC, right? It depends on how tightly the spring is wound and all sorts of other things. But it parameterizes a particular spring. So we've got the potential energy. And you remember the potential energy was useful because the potential energy, the change in the potential energy, was minus the work done by the spring. And that was helpful because we had the work kinetic energy theorem, which said that if we took the total work done by all of the forces, that was equal to the change in the kinetic energy. So if the only force present is the one from the spring, then this total work is equal to minus the change in the potential energy. And if we bring the minus thing over to the other side of the equation, what we've got is that zero is equal to the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy, which is, of course, just the statement of conservation of energy. Now, we've got kind of a similar problem to what we had with steam engines, right? We talked about the work done by the steam and the work we did on the spring, on the steam. And the same thing is going to apply here. If we're talking about the work we do to stretch a spring, it's going to be plus the change in potential energy. So sometimes the book is asking for the work done by the spring, and sometimes it's asking about the work it would take to stretch the spring. And you have to look carefully at the words to see whether that's plus or minus the change in the potential energy. Okay, so with conservation of energy, we can say that the total energy is equal to the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And we can graphically put this together by making a graph in which we graph the potential energy versus x, right, which is a quadratic. Say it looks like that. If we have a certain amount of energy, we can draw that as a constant horizontal line. And if we're at some position x, we can see that there's going to be this much potential energy and this much kinetic energy. Because, of course, the sum of the kinetic energy and the potential energy has to be the total energy. So if we think about the particle moving along the x-axis, at this point it has no potential energy, so it has lots of kinetic energy. As it progresses, the kinetic energy gets less and less and less, which says it slows down. Finally, it reaches a maximum displacement, which I'm going to call A. And at that point, we have a turning point because it's going to go from moving to the right to moving to the left. And then it's going to pick up kinetic energy again, have its maximum when it goes through equilibrium. And then it's going to have less and less and less kinetic energy until it reaches minus A. So this A we call the amplitude. And it shows the range of variation of the motion. So if we have kind of this sort of simple harmonic oscillator, it's oscillating about this spot. It has some maximum amplitude, and it's just going back and forth, back and forth. And we can calculate this energy. For example, we could calculate it when it's at its extreme position. So then there's no kinetic energy. So this energy has to be equal to 1/2 kx at that time. Or we could calculate the energy when it's going through equilibrium. Then there's no potential energy. So all of the energy will be kinetic energy. So we have all of those equivalent forms for energy. So if we think about what this motion looks like, if we were to try and plot it up, so if I try and plot x now vertically, we started at some big spot and it went to the opposite spot, went back up, constantly going left, right, left, right. The amplitude is the maximum deviation that it has from equilibrium. The time it takes to go through one cycle, we usually call that the period, and we denote that by the symbol T. We also usually talk about things in terms of the frequency. Frequency in terms of cycles per second. So if we count the number of complete cycles in some time, we can calculate the frequency as the number of cycles divided by the time. And in particular, of course, we go through one cycle in one period. So the frequency has to be 1 over the period. And finally, we remember from rotational motion that we had the angular frequency, which we denoted with that Greek letter that looks like a W but is an omega. So that was 2 pi over the period, where 2 pi times the frequency, same thing. Okay, so this is all pretty much stuff that we dealt with before. And we're going to deal with it again in a lot of these homework problems.
Does that say 2 pi frequency at the end?
Yes, 2 pi times f, where we usually denote f with the frequency.
What's the symbol under 1 over?
T.
T?
T. T as in Tom. So frequency is the number of cycles per time, and we go through one cycle in one period.
Okay, is that like a Greek symbol?
No.
It's just a weird T?
You don't... T's are always weird.
Is it supposed to have a X on the side of it to like denote period though? Or is it
just... It's just a T for period. So we can spell out letters like YMCA, I guess. So what's the timing of this motion? That is to say, if we look at this graph, I hope it reminds you of a sine or a cosine, something that's sinusoidal. So we're kind of expecting that this should be sinusoidal behavior. Remember that we have lots of graphs and equations that give us, for example, the position versus time for a free-falling object. So we'd like similar sorts of equations for an object that's oscillating back and forth. If I pick a time, what's the corresponding value of x? And we can actually get a handle on that if we think about circular motion. So first of all, what has to be the case for, yes?
Is that a p at the end of that last equation over there?
A p. 2i
frequency.
Frequency. Yeah, it does look like a P. So let's think about what the equations would require. So we know that F equals ma, and we know that the force is minus kx. So what we need to find is a situation where x is equal to x times minus k over m is equal to the acceleration. And what turns out to work is to think about looking at something that's moving in a circle, but think about looking at it from below. If we think about what the x value is, if we're at some angle that's omega t, then the x value of that is, of course, going to be the radius of the circle, the hypotenuse, times the cosine of the angle, which is omega t. Circular motion, where typically we're doing this in radians now. And you remember that there's centripetal acceleration. So the acceleration of this object points towards the center of the circle, and that acceleration has magnitude that's omega squared r. If we look at just the x component of that acceleration, it's just the same angle, omega t. So the acceleration in the x direction is just omega squared r minus omega squared r times cosine of omega t. Yeah, if we just kind of plug and chug, so if the acceleration is minus omega squared r times cosine of omega t, and x is equal to r times cosine of omega t, notice that lots of things are going to cancel out. The minus signs are going to cancel out. The r's are going to cancel out. Cosine of omega t is the same. So what we're going to have then is that k over m is equal to omega squared. So we can predict the angular frequency of a simple harmonic oscillator by taking the square root of K over M. Okay, so what we've got here is X is equal to, I'll write it as amplitude because we usually do it that way, cosine of omega t. And we have an acceleration that is minus omega squared a cosine of omega t. If we think about the velocity vector, the velocity should be tangent to the circle. And we only want the x component of that velocity vector. Now, we could go through the trigonometry, but what I tell you is if you do, what you're going to get is the velocity is minus omega a sine of omega t. So these equations play kind of the same role as x is equal to x naught plus v naught t plus 1 half at squared, for example. And the velocity is equal to v naught plus at. Right, those are the equations that dealt with the case of constant acceleration. These are the equations that apply to simple harmonic motion, the motion on of an object on a spring.
In those cosine signs, is that omega t? Or
yes.
Omega t?
Mm-hmm. So as time goes on, we're advancing this angle. Mm-hmm. And viewed from below, what we're seeing is this thing just going back and forth. So from your perspective, something that's going around in a circle looks a lot like this thing that's going back and forth.
Is for V, is that also an omega, or does that work?
Nope. These are all
W's. Are
all W's.
No, at the beginning, the L,
yep.
V.
Yep, all these. Omega. The only works occur right here.
Does the centrifugal force that A equals...
Say that again.
Centripetal acceleration.
Centripetal. Good, centripetal.
Do we have to use that same equation that we had before for this, or that's different?
So we had two equations. We had V squared over R, and we had omega squared R.
Okay, and we're using the omega squared.
And you could use the other one if you really wanted to. Yeah, so the velocity here is the maximum velocity, so this would be omega times A, and you can, or excuse me, omega times R. So we're back to where we started from.
Okay.
What are those two equations left of the box on the top of it?
So those are the equations that we had for free fall motion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly relevant to this, to what we're dealing with, right? X is equal to X naught plus V sub OT plus 1 half AT squared. It's what we did on the first exam. So all I'm saying is that what we have is something that's equivalent to that. We have position and time and acceleration as functions of time. More questions? So it's not as bad as when I plumped 4 times 6 equations in a table, but there are a good number of equations that we have for simple harmonic motion. One sheet of paper, both sides. Okay, so how does this all apply to kind of typical homework problems? So we can start out with kind of the typical plug and chug sort of problems. So here we have 50 newtons that'll stretch a spring 5 centimeters. What force is required to stretch it by 11 centimeters? So we can work this in a simple proportion sort of way. We know that the force divided by the displacement is supposed to be a constant. So we can say then, like we did for the ideal gas, F1 over X1 should be F2 over X2. So we have that we've got 50 newtons stretching by 5 centimeters, and we have an unknown number of newtons required to stretch it by 11 centimeters. And you remember, one of the nice reasons to use this sort of form is we didn't have to go and make sure that we used MKS units. Because if I go and solve for F2, I'm going to get the ratio of stretches, and the units will cancel out. So I don't know, I can do this one in my head. Centimeters go away, the fives go away, so we have 110 newtons. Now, I'm playing kind of fast and loose with that minus sign. And remember that if I were doing this problem exactly correct, I would comment that in fact, if I have stretched it a positive 5 centimeters, then the force is going to be minus 50. But there's kind of no reason to, I think, go to that extreme. We can just use this relationship and remember that the sign is just there. The total information content of that sign is just that the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement. So in terms of magnitude of forces, the force over the displacement is a constant. So we can plot the force versus position, and for the equation F equals minus KX, of course it's going to have a negative constant slope, kind of like that. Okay, you pull back your bow 40 centimeters and it takes a force of 230 newtons to do that. What's the spring constant? So again, we can just essentially ignore the minus sign or remember to put it in later. So I'll say the 230 newtons divided by the 0.4 meters is going to be the spring constant. So I get 575. And what are the units? Well, the units, of course, are going to be newtons per meter. It's not named for any famous dead physicist yet. Hooke would be the right person to name it for, since he's the guy who developed this equation about the same time as Newton. How much work is done in pulling the bow? So this isn't how much work the bow is doing. This is how much work we have to do on the bow. So we don't want to use this minus sign. We want to use this plus sign. And if you get confused, just think about whether you're doing work or not, right? To pull a bow back took some effort, so we ought to have a positive amount of work that we did. Okay, so the work that we do, that's equal to the change in the potential energy. Change is final minus initial. So on the final situation, we have stretched the bow by 0.4 meters. And initially, it wasn't stretched at all. So what we've got is 1 half times this 575 times 0.4 squared.
Is that a 0 squared?
Yeah. Yes, because the initial position is 0. So let's check our units. We've got newtons per meter in the spring constant, and it's being multiplied by meters squared. So we can cancel out one of those meters, and you might remember Newton meter is worth a joule. Okay, so in terms of numbers, we've got 0.4 squared times the 575 and then divide everything by 2 and I get 46 joules.
How do we know when, so, because it says total work equals change in kinetic energy, but that doesn't relate to springs in a way, because isn't the kinetic energy we still use is the half mv squared?
So this equation is, this equation here is always true. So this is really, I would say, a prediction. That is to say, kinetic energy is defined to be 1/2 mv squared, and we predict how much change there'll be by how much work was done. Oh, for this one?
Yeah.
That's because we were asked different things.
Okay.
Right? So we were asked, what is the work required to stretch the spring? And that's equal to the change in the potential energy.
Okay. What would be, could you give an example of when we would use the change in kinetic energy instead?
Mm-hmm. This one here?
Yeah.
So if we release the arrow, all of that potential energy is going to be converted to kinetic energy. So we could use minus the change in the potential energy of the spring is equal to the change in the kinetic energy. So it's going to go from zero to some final kinetic energy.
So can you relate negative
PE to
positive change in
KE? So for this negative sign, if we brought it over to this side of the equation, we got this, which was conservation of energy. So we got to remember which one is going to be the change. So the minus the change in the potential energy is going to be 1/2 k the initial x squared minus 1/2 k the final x squared. If we have the arrow stretched, then the initial value is going to be kind of like this 0.4 meters. And the final value is going to be zero. So we're going to get numerically exactly the same value that we got. So the arrow after it's shot is also going to have 46 joules of energy. So it takes 46 joules to pull it back, and that energy is going to be converted into kinetic energy when we release the arrow. More questions? Okay, so look carefully at this work done, whether it's work done by the spring or work done by the person who is stretching the spring. They differ by sign. Okay, so here we've got a problem that goes to part G, so that'll be exciting. So we've got a horizontal spring system, pretty much like what is set up there, and they tell us that it's got 47 joules of energy, and that the maximum displacement is 0.24 meters. What's the spring constant? So we're looking kind of for a relationship between amplitude and energy and spring constant, and we've got it right here. The energy is equal to 1/2 kA squared. So we know the amplitude, we know the energy, we can calculate the spring constant. So if we take twice the energy and divide it by the amplitude squared, we're supposed to get the spring constant. So we've got energy is 1/2 kA squared. So K is equal to twice the energy divided by the amplitude squared. So we've got 2 times 47 divided by the 0.24. Let's check our units. So we have joules per meter squared. And remember that a joule is a Newton meter. So we can get rid of one of those meters, and Newton meter is exactly what we are looking for our units for spring constant. So in terms of the actual number, we've got twice 47 divided by 0.24 squared. And I have 1632. What's the kinetic energy of the system when it's at equilibrium? Well, when it's going through equilibrium, there's zero potential energy because x is equal to zero. And we know from conservation of energy these things have to add up to the energy. So if this is zero, all of the energy has to be kinetic energy when it's going through equilibrium. So we got 47 joules when it's going through equilibrium. What's the speed of the... So they tell us the speed and they want the mass. Well, so that's a plug and chug, because we know that we have 47 joules and it's equal to 1/2 mv squared. And they've told us that the velocity is 3.45 meters per second. So the mass is going to be twice the 47 joules divided by the 3.45 squared. Let's check our units. So we have joules divided by meters squared per second squared. And we know that a joule is a Newton meter. So we can get rid of one of those meters. And I hope you remember that a Newton is MA, so it's a kilogram meter per second squared. So we got meter squared per second squared, top and bottom. So yeah, we're going to get out kilograms from this result. So we got 47 times 2 and 3.45 squared. And I get basically 7.9 kilograms. What's the speed of the block when it's at 0.16 meters? So what we have is kind of a situation like this. We know what the total energy is. They have picked a particular spot, so we know what the potential energy of that spot is, so we can calculate the kinetic energy. And if we know the mass, we can calculate what the speed is at that spot. Let's do all of that in a generic sort of way as opposed to a particular sort of way. So what we've got in general is the energy is equal to 1/2 the mass times the velocity squared, the kinetic energy, times the potential energy. If we multiply everything by 2, we've got that. I want to solve for the velocity, so let me bring the kx squared over to the other side of the equation. And if I divide through by the mass and take the square root, that's what I've got. Now we can make this slightly nicer form if we remember that the energy could be written in terms of the amplitude, 1/2 kA squared. So if I put that in, what I've got is k over m a squared minus k over m x squared. So I've got k over m's in both terms. I can pull those out. And square root of k over m is omega. Now I kind of glossed over a potential problem. If I know the particle is here, I don't know whether it's continuing out or coming in. The speed, the velocity could be positive or negative when I take the square root. They're both possibilities at that position.
Would that be a universal formula?
Or yes. Yep, this is a good formula for lots of situations. So you're going to use that formula. So it's a consequence of energy conservation, so you could always rederive it from energy conservation. But there are a couple of problems that ask you for the velocity given x, and that's what that equation is all set up to do.
And that one
No. The only work has been here.
What's that equal to?
That's equal to the speed. And it could be plus or minus if I talk about velocity.
Is that dependent on like if it's going in or out?
Yep.
So out would be positive and negative?
Yep. Okay, so with that, we can plug and chug. So we've got that the speed is equal to omega, which is the square root of k over m, and we've got k, which is 1632, and we've got m, which is 7.9, and then we've got the square root of the amplitude, and they tell us that the amplitude is 0.24, and they're asking us about this position that is 0.16. So omega is kind of an important number, so it might be smart to calculate it by itself, square root of k over m. So we got 1632 and 7.9, and we're supposed to take the square root of that. And what I get is 14.37. And typically when we're talking about omegas, the units of omega are going to have inverse time, but to remind us that this is in radians, we usually write radians per second. So a radian is dimensionless, so you can write it or not, but radians per second is helpful to remind you that when you plug into these sorts of equations, you better be using radians. Okay, so the rest of this is simple. We just have 0.24 squared minus 0.16 squared square rooted. And I get 2.57 meters per second. Let's check our units. So this quantity here was the square root of like an amplitude squared. So that's giving us the meters. And the seconds are coming from omega. And the radians don't really count, right? They don't really have units. No. So pretty much we never, you in this class you'll be safe if you never use grams.
Okay.
You always use kilograms. And that's what's behind this MKS system.
Okay.
Right? The K for kilograms, meters, seconds that we love to use. Okay, so we got the speed when it's at that location. Find the kinetic energy. So if you know the speed, the kinetic energy is easy to calculate, right? It's just 1/2 mv squared. So here's the velocity. The mass was 7.9. So we've got 1/2 of 7.9 times this. 2.57 squared. I got the 2.57 still sitting in my calculator, so I can square it, multiply it by 7.9, and divide by 2, and I get 26.1 what? Joules, right? Energy is in joules. If we're in doubt about it, we could check our units, right? Because we have mass times velocity. So we've got kilograms times meters squared per second squared. And it's been a while since we've worried about newtons, but a newton is a kilogram meter per second squared. And we've got a meter left over. So it's a newton meter. And that's a joule. Find the potential energy. Well, we could easily calculate the potential energy. by plugging and chugging into this formula. On the other hand, we know that whatever energy isn't potential energy is kinetic energy, and vice versa. So if we want the potential energy, all we have to do is take the total energy, 47 joules, and subtract off the 26.1 that are in kinetic energy, and the remainder better be potential energy. Kinetic energy plus potential energy has to equal total energy. Okay, so far we've been using conservation of energy, and here they say we can't use conservation of energy. We're supposed to assume that it's released from 0.24 meters, but on a surface with friction, so that the energy is going to be converted into heat by friction, and it's going to lose 14 joules of energy by the time it reaches its first turning point. So kind of the picture you should have, position versus time. We start here at 0.24 centimeters. We go through equilibrium, but we don't reach the minus 2.4 spot because we've used up a certain amount of energy. So at the turning point, the velocity is zero, so 100% of the energy is potential energy. And we know the amount of energy that's there, right? We started with 47 joules and we lost 14. So we know what K is. It's the 1632. So we have everything we need in order to calculate X. So X squared is going to be 2 times the 47 minus 14 joules of energy divided by the 1632 spring constant. So we started with 47 joules of energy and we lost 14, and we're figuring out what X value has that amount of potential energy. Oops, wrong button. So if I made a correction correctly, X is equal to 0.201 meters. So if energy had been conserved, it would have gone all the way out to 0.24, but some energy was used up, so it only went out to 0.2. Okay, so here they give us the position versus time of a simple harmonic oscillator. And it's not exactly set up with what we've been talking about. We've been talking about position functions that started at equilibrium and oscillated around equilibrium. But this function at time equals zero is equal to zero. So this thing is a sine function as opposed to a cosine function. But I hope it's clear that there isn't a big difference between the sines and the cosines. They're both just oscillating. So if we kind of line up what we know, for what we've said, X is equal to A times cosine of omega T. What they've told us is that X is equal to 5.2 centimeters times the sine of 8 pi times T. So the extremes of sine are like the extremes of cosine, just plus and minus 1. So the amplitude has to be this 5.2 centimeters. So sine and cosine aren't exactly the same, but they're just oscillating back and forth. So it must be that omega is the same thing as this 8 pi. We good with that? Okay, so then we're all set. If we know that omega is 8 pi, we know that omega is equal to 2 pi over the period with this nice little serifs on it. So the period is going to be 2 pi over 8 pi, which is 1/4 of a second. The frequency of the motion, well, the frequency is just 1 over the period. So 1/4 is 4. The units are cycles per second. But we've said that Hertz is such a nice guy, we're going to name that for him. So 4 Hertz. When is the position going to equal 2.6 centimeters? Okay, so let's kind of graph out this relationship. So if we plot the sine function, it's going to go up, down, up, down. It's going to reach maximums that are 5.2 centimeters and minimums that are minus 5.2 centimeters. And the question is asking about when is it going to reach 2.6 centimeters? And you can see it's going to pass 2.6 centimeters lots of times. Once going out and once going in, and then forever the same. So they're asking us about this first time when it equals 2.6 centimeters. So if x equals 2.6 centimeters, what we need to do is to solve for the corresponding time. So 2.6 is nicely half of 5.2. So when we bring the 5.2 over, we get 2.6 divided by 5.2, which is a half. That wants to equal sine of 8 pi t. So now we have to somehow or other bring the sine over to that side of the equation, as it were. And we do that by using the inverse sine, right? If we know the sine is something, we can find out what the argument is by the inverse sine. So the inverse sine of a half is going to equal 8 pi t. So the time is going to be the inverse sine of a half divided by 8 pi. When we use trigonometric functions and we're using radians, we better make sure we're in radian modes and not degree modes. And I'm not sure I am, so I'm in radian modes now. So I want the inverse sine of 0.5. On this calculator, it's labeled a sine. And the inverse sine is 0.523. Divide that by 8 pi. Incidentally, it's exactly equal to pi over 6. But we don't know that yet. So divide that by 8 and divide that by pi. And I get a time that is 0.0208 seconds. Now, when you work this sort of problem, it's sometimes smart to kind of benchmark it. So we know that the time it takes to complete one cycle, we figured out the period someplace, it's 1/4 of a second. So the time it takes to go through a half cycle is going to be 1/8 of a second. The time it takes it to go through this quarter cycle is going to be 1/16 of a second. So we're looking at something that is roughly 1/32 of a second or so. And that is in the same ballpark as this, right? 1/32 is, I think, about 0.03. So we're barking up about the right tree. Okay, so use radian mode when you're doing these sorts of problems. Okay, so now we've got another one of these type G problems. So here we've got a spring that will stretch 3 centimeters if we apply a force that is 7.5 newtons. And we're going to put a half kilogram mass on it in a horizontal sort of situation like that. And we're going to stretch the spring by 5 centimeters and release it. And we're supposed to figure out lots of things. So these are good problems from a WebAssign point of view, right? They're worth lots of points. Okay. So the basic data, we're going to need the spring constant first. And you remember that the spring constant is the force divided by the position, where we're kind of ignoring the sign because we've learned that. So we've got the 7.5 newtons. We're going to convert the 3 centimeters to meters because we want to be using the MKS system. And so we're going to have a spring constant that is 7.5 divided by 0.03, which is exactly 250 newtons per meter. Oh, so that, I guess, was A. What's the force constant? What's the angular frequency and the period of the motion? So omega was the square root of k over m. So this is the square root of 250 divided by 0.5 kilograms. So it's the square root of 500, which is 22.36. radians per second. You don't have to use the radians. They're unitless, actually, by themselves. What's the period? Well, omega is equal to 2 pi over t. So t is equal to 2 pi over omega. And I've got my omega sitting in my calculator. So I've got 2, and I've got pi. And I just need to divide them. And I get 0.281 seconds. What's the total energy? Well, that's an easy one point, right? Because the total energy can be calculated from the amplitude squared. So we have 1/2 times the 250 times the amplitude converted to meters, which was 5 centimeters, if I remember correctly. So I got 0.05 squared and 250. And 2 divided by that, and I get an energy that is 0.3125 joules. So that's the always energy that it has. We already know that the amplitude of the motion is the amplitude, which we started with the 5 centimeters. Maximum velocity and maximum acceleration. Well, let's start with acceleration. So we haven't been asked about acceleration for a while. When last we heard, F was equal to ma, and it's still true. We know the force is minus kx. So the acceleration is minus k over m times x. So we're going to get the biggest acceleration where we have the biggest value of x. Now we can worry a little bit about this minus sign. When it's at a maximum x, it's accelerating backwards. So technically speaking, to maximize the acceleration vector, then we would want to have x be minus the amplitude. But either way you think about it, we've got a k that is 250 divided by the mass, which is 0.5, and the amplitude that is 0.05. And what we've got then is Did I do that right? I didn't do it right. What are the units on that? Yep. And we could check that, but if we're good MKS people, we're going to get a good MKS unit when we're done.
The negative K also balances out because the X was negative in this.
So if we want to make this look exactly correct, then I do want to use, to get a positive acceleration, I want the particle displaced as much to this side as possible. So I would want to be putting in X is minus 0.05. But frankly, that's not kind of how I thought about it. I kind of ignored the minus sign because I know the minus sign is just giving me the direction. And I know that if it's positive on one side, it's going to be negative on the other side. Oh, maximum velocity. Well, so there's many different ways we could work this. I guess conservation of energy is coming to mind immediately. When it has its maximum velocity is when it has no potential energy. And so all of the energy is in kinetic energy. So all of these joules are going to be equal to 1/2 mv². So we know what the mass is. So the velocity is going to be 2 times the energy divided by the mass. And I get 1.12. meters per second. Okay, so then they're going to ask us where is the particle at a particular time. And in the end, they're going to ask us for the velocity and the acceleration at that same time. So this particle was started at a maximum position, so we can apply exactly these equations. So to get the x value, I've got the amplitude times the cosine of omega. And so I'm thinking that that's the right omega, 22.36. And we've got a time that is 1/2 a second. Do notice that 1/2 a second is, we go through several periods in that 1/2 a second, right? So it's not going immediately, it's oscillating around before it's reaching that spot. And do notice that we better be in radian mode when we calculate this cosine. So we got 22.36, 1/2 of that, then we're supposed to take the cosine of that and multiply it by 0.05, and I get a very small value. I'll write it exponentially, 9.17 times 10 to the minus 3rd meters. Yeah, so roughly a centimeter. The velocity is minus omega A times the sine of omega T. So we know that the omega is the 22.36. We've got an amplitude that is 0.05. They've asked us at about a time that is 0.5 seconds, so we should be all set to calculate that one. So 22.36 times 1/2 a second, take the sine of that and multiply it by 0.05 and by omega and put in the minus sign, and what I get is 1.10 meters per second. It's pretty close to equilibrium, so that's pretty close to the maximum speed. And the acceleration, we can go through and calculate it this way, or you can kind of cheat and see that that quantity is exactly the same thing as x. So this is minus omega squared times x. And we calculated x right there. So we've got minus 22.36 times that value for our acceleration. And I get minus 4.58 meters per second squared. You remember that the maximum acceleration was 25 meters per second squared, so we're well off the maximum acceleration. Okay, so a boatload of equations, not the most equations I've ever given you at once. Half of them are review, and review is good before a final. Monday.
Next week?
No. And don't forget your lab practical. Absolutely want to do that, practice it beforehand, and if you want it graded, you can give me an email and a few hours to look at it. And I will shoot you back some sort of answer.
And that's going to be in this cycle?
Yes. So there's a sign-up sheet on the lab door.